I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Florida is in the rearview mirror, but all roads lead back to the Sunshine State, and Mitt Romney positioned himself to return to Florida in August as his party's nominee by handily winning the GOP presidential primary there last night.
I will make America the most attractive place in the world for entrepreneurs, for innovators, for job creators. And unlike the other people running for president, I know how to do that because I've done it before.
But despite being beaten by 15 points, Newt Gingrich sounded like he was the conquering hero, saying there are still 46 states to go.
You know, the same people who said I was dead in June and July and said I was gone after Iowa, who seemed totally quiet the night of the South Carolina victory, are now going to be back saying, what's he going to do, what's he going to do, what's he going to do? So I just want to reassure them tonight. We are going to contest every place, and we are going to win, and we will be in Tampa as the nominee in August.
But as the candidates now head west, including to Nevada, which has its caucuses on Saturday, will the negative campaigning continue? And how beat up will the candidate be that eventually does face President Barack Obama in the general election? We're going to chew over that for a few minutes this morning. Joining us from New Jersey, pollster Scott Rasmussen of Rasmussen Reports. Scott, welcome back as always.
It's great to be with you.
And from Austin, Texas, Republican strategist Mark McKinnon. He worked as media advisor to former George W. Bush. He was also on the 2008 John McCain campaign. Mark, welcome back to you as well.
Hey, thanks much.
And let's start with you, Mark. You've been on the front lines. I mentioned the 2008 campaign, but people are comparing Florida to the fight in South Carolina between George W. Bush and John McCain. We all remember the allegations that Bush's campaign used push polling to ask questions like, would you be more or less likely to vote for John McCain if you knew he'd adopted a black child? McCain had, in fact, adopted a Bangladesh child. But, you know, it got very nasty, as you know, in that campaign. How would you characterize Florida? How are Republicans looking at what happened in Florida? Are you comparing it to other times?
Well, the reason that Florida is important are several reasons. One, it's a huge state, but more importantly, unlike South Carolina, unlike New Hampshire, unlike Iowa, that are very unique places, Florida has a very diverse demographic and population, and it's much more like the rest of America. So it is generally a better bellwether, not so much in what happens in Florida itself, but it's often an indicator about what's likely to happen when you get to those similar, more diverse populations around the rest of the country, and that's why it's important.
But what about the nastiness? I mean, I'm hearing, you know, on various radio shows, I'm hearing Republican analysts saying it's reminding people of George H.W. Bush and Reagan, you know, when there were, you know, criticism thrown back and forth. You know, people are looking back to other times, and we're hearing voters. Scott Rasmussen, chime in here if you have any polling on this. We're hearing voters in Florida saying, you know, I'm going to vote, but I'm feeling dirty about it. You know, the 13,000 or so ads from Mitt Romney, 92% of the ads negative, 200 or so ads from Newt Gingrich, but just this feel of negativity. I mean, is this just politics as usual, or is there something different going on here?
There's not something different going on. This is a process. It's a part that everybody says they hate negative ads, but it's just like gossip. They may hate it, but they keep taking part in it. And one of the reasons in campaigns is it works. It will set up a different dynamic in general election because in the primary, despite all the efforts of the candidates to make massive distinctions between their own positions, Gingrich, Santorum, Mitt Romney all have more in common than they do with Barack Obama.
And you know what, Scott Rasmussen, you know what? Your phone is obviously being tapped. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to tell you to hang up. We're going to call you back on your cell phone. This is what we love about our program. We're live. We're in the middle of the mix of news, and so we're just going to carry on with Mark. And Mark, question to you. You may have seen already the new cover of the new New Yorker. It's a cartoon of President Obama. You know, he's sitting back on the couch. Looks like he's watching the Super Bowl. You know, he's got a beer. But in fact, he's watching Mitt Romney tackling Newt Gingrich. You know, so again, you know, what do you think the impact of this negativity has been, will be? Can it continue? Are party elders circling and saying, you know, we need to do something here?
Yeah, well, let me diverge from what Scott said just a little bit. And what's different this time is it's not just the tone, but it's the weight and the level of those messages. And the reason for that is because of these new super PACs, which means that the campaigns are now spending 3, 4, 5 times more money than was spent in previous campaigns. So it's not so much that that the tactics or the strategies are different. It's just the sheer volume of it. And I think that there's some data that indicates that that there is some repercussions from this, that voters aren't particularly happy about the tone of the campaign. Now, as Scott said, that's, you know, campaigns are tough, and that's the way it is in American campaigns. But I think something different may be going on here. A year ago, I think that a lot of us would have said that given the economic fundamentals and the way the campaign was going, we could say that it was very likely a Republican was going to win and we could nominate just about anybody. I think that equation has changed a lot given the nature of the campaign, the tone of the campaign, the way these primaries are playing out. And I think right now you could say it's absolutely going to be a jump ball.
Well, some of the polls seem to back you up, Mark McKinnon. The new ABC Washington Post poll, a national poll of Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, shows Romney's unfavorability rating rising from 31% in September to 49% in late January. His favorability stayed at 31%, but his unfavorability went to 49%. Gingrich's unfavorability rating went from 51%, went up to 51%, and with 29% favorable. So both men saw their unfavorability going up. Scott Rasmussen, I believe we have you back. And just what is your polling showing?
Yeah, I am back, and I think Mark is right that the sheer weight of the ads is having some impact, and he's right that the race right now looks like it is a 50-50 prospect for which candidate would win the general election. I think one of the reasons for that, though, has nothing to do with the Republican primary and everything to do with the state of the economy. People are feeling much more confident or perhaps much less pessimistic than they were a few months ago. At the end of last summer, only 27% of Americans said their own finances were in good shape. That was down 8 points since Barack Obama took office. It's now moved back up 8 points. So people, as they're feeling better about their finances, feel better about the president. There is some negativity. It does have an impact. And if I said before that I didn't think there was any impact, I would like to correct that. But we also see the number of people who identify as Democrats has been drifting down in the last couple of months. So it's, again, not people not becoming excited about the Republicans, but they're becoming disillusioned about both parties.
Yeah, well, there's that. And it just doesn't seem as if sticking with the Republicans now, who are obviously are in the spotlight because of their primary season, it doesn't seem like it is going to change. Mark McKinnon, Bill Kristol of the Weekly Standard writes today that the GOP primary could be heading to a Romney-Santorum standoff. I mean, the sense in the speeches last night, and Mitt Romney would love to telegraph the message that he's sort of leaving Newt Gingrich in his dust. However, Bill Kristol is saying there may be somebody else. He says Santorum could do well in these upcoming caucuses this month. February is thought to be a sleepy month for the contest. We don't have a lot of debates till the end of the month, but 187 delegates up for grabs compared to just 115 in January. Mark McKinnon, start there. Your thoughts on that, that this may be nowhere near over and there may be another contender.
I think that's absolutely right. We've been referring to this as the yo-yo primary, and I think we got a few more yos left. There's a sort of a conventional wisdom right now that Romney's wrapping things up and that he's going to roll through February. Politics is always about expectations game, and the problem now is that expectations are sky high for Mitt Romney, and I think it's very likely that we could see a scenario for where any three of the other candidates, Paul, Santorum, or Gingrich, could have a good night. For example, Ron Paul could have a good night at the Nevada caucuses, not win them, but exceed expectations. Caucuses are great for Ron Paul in the way he organizes. And or you could see a sort of coalescing of the conservatives around Rick Santorum. Alternatively, you could see Newt Gingrich have a really good night on Super Tuesday and get a lot of delegates in the South. I think the really important number to focus on is 7%, and that's the number of delegates that Mitt Romney has now accumulated of the number that he needs. So he's not even 10% of the way there yet.
Well, I was hearing that, and Scott weigh in on this, that even if Mitt Romney gets 100% of all the delegates for the next couple of months, it still goes to at least April. And since nobody thinks he's going to get 100%, it's definitely going to be in play through, you know, beyond.
Well, the answer, I agree with Mark. This is something that is far from over. I would compare what Mitt Romney has done so far as a football team that's had a good first quarter that has a good lead, they're certainly favored to win with that big lead, but there's an awful lot of time left in the game. And when we're looking at the situation, I heard Mark articulate a couple of scenarios. There may be some others that nobody's thought of. It is likely that sometime near the end of March, and perhaps into mid-April, we will have a pretty good sense of who the nominee is, but it won't be wrapped up. It won't be mathematically finished until much later.
Well, I want both of you to weigh in on what you think the candidates might do from here on out, especially since the concern seems to be that with the negative ads, they're beating up, as Rush Limbaugh constantly says, you're beating up more on each other than anyone has been on the sitting, you know, Democratic president. But what's been put in play, obviously, Scott, you talk about the concerns about the economy, but what's been put in play is, you know, inequity in pay. Mitt Romney's history at Bain Capital, that's all been put in play by the Republicans. And today on CNN, Romney made a remark. He makes it clear he wants to focus on the middle class, but he made an awkward, some could say, an awkward comment about the poor. Let's listen first.
I'm not concerned about the very poor. We have a safety net there. If it needs a repair, I'll fix it. I'm not concerned about the very rich. They're doing just fine. I'm concerned about the very heart of America, the 90, 95% of Americans who right now are struggling, and I'll continue to take that message across the nation.
Now, Sold Out O'Brien followed up saying, boy, that comment about, you know, not being concerned about the poor might sound harsh. Romney pointed out that he said he would fix safety nets, but it sort of, you know, might hang in there along with another comment. I enjoy firing people. And of course, he went on to say, I enjoy firing people who don't perform well. So, Mark, you know, just what do you think the candidates have to do now, especially Mitt Romney, who's he and his competitors have been giving the Democrats a lot of fodder?
Well, the execution may have been off, but at least I think the strategy was right in the sense that the Romney at least understands that Team Obama is onto a message that's getting a lot of traction, which is this idea of the middle class and talking about the pie that's out there and how it gets divided. And I think he recognized that he potentially, you know, anytime you have a message, you want your opponent to sort of be the flip side of that. And the problem for Romney is that he is the flip side of that whole middle class message, which is where Obama's heading. And that's a big problem, and that's why the whole Bain issue is a problem. The taxes are a problem. So I think it's pretty clear that he at least understands strategically that he's got to get after a middle-class message and start to define it. Now, as you noted, the execution today wasn't particularly deft.
Mark McKinnon, who worked as a media advisor to both President George W. Bush and John McCain. Scott Rasmussen of Rasmussen Report. Scott, you know we'll always have you back. I got to cut it now because we're up against a break, but I want to remind everyone that your new book is The People's Money. It just came out this week. Scott, you'll be back to help us as the Republicans make their way to their convention in August in Florida. Scott, thanks to you. And Mark, thanks to you as well.
Thanks. Kick it.
Our hometown is giving a former mayor his last hurrah today. Kevin White ran Boston from 1968 to 84. He's being lauded as a visionary who launched a waterfront building boom that was copied around the country. He's also being criticized for not doing more to help the city through one of its worst chapters, forced busing. But before that, Kevin White was applauded for something he did on April 5, 1968. It was the day after Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. Riots had broken out across the country. There was unrest in the Roxbury section of Boston. Soul singer James Brown was scheduled to play at the old Boston Garden. Some city officials wanted to cancel. But a young African-American city councilman, Tom Atkins, proposed televising the concert live. Mayor White convinced a local station to do just that, overcoming non-compete issues. Reporter Michael May tells the story.
Music journalist Tom Vickers was one of the few white people with a ticket to the James Brown concert that night. He was 18 years old at the time. He grew up in Boston and was a huge fan of R&B. He was well aware of just how much tension there was between whites and blacks in the city. For the most part, whites stayed in South Boston, and blacks stayed in a neighborhood called Roxbury.
If you were a black person and you were found on the streets of South Boston, you were lucky to escape alive. The inverse was true. If you were a white person walking the streets of Roxbury, there was danger. You know, you could feel it. It was palpable.
The tension had been escalating in the mid-60s. as the city began to desegregate its public schools. The mayoral race in 1967 pitted a liberal reformer, Kevin White, against Louise Day Hicks, an opponent of desegregation. Hicks ran under the evasive slogan, "You know where I stand." White won the race by less than 12,000 votes. So Boston's race relations were already on a short fuse when Martin Luther King was shot and killed on April 4, 1968. Riots broke out across the country, and some feared Boston would be next. Tom Vickers remembered there was some rioting in Roxbury Friday night that was quickly stopped.
Yet there was this ongoing fear that there would be mass rioting in Boston, that, you know, the African-American community would spread into these various communities in Boston and just tear up the place.
In fact, city leaders were terrified that the James Brown concert would bring the violence right into the heart of downtown. Mayor Kevin White and Boston's first black city council member, Thomas Atkins, debated whether or not to cancel the concert. They talked about the decision in a VH1 documentary. Mayor Kevin White speaks first.
His concert, we thought, might bring as many as 15 or 20,000 black people from the community, particularly young people, into the city. It just had too much emotion in it not to decide whether that would be a problem.
And I said, "Kevin, you are doing exactly the wrong thing. If the word gets out in the black community that the city would not let James Brown come to town and perform, in the wake of King's assassination," I said, "all hell will break loose."
The city had only a few hours to find a compromise. Meanwhile, Tom Vickers went to a somber memorial for Dr. King that afternoon in Government Center near downtown. Afterwards, he went to the Boston Garden and asked a large Irish policeman if the show was still going to happen.
And he said, "Yeah, it's going to happen, but if I were you, I'd just turn in your tickets and get a refund." And I said, "Well, if the show's going to happen, why would I want to do that?" And he said, "Well, it could be a little edgy here tonight, and here's the good news. They're going to broadcast the entire show."
The mayor held a press conference to encourage people to stay home and watch it in the safety of their living room.
Give another round of applause for James Brown.
That night, around 9 p.m., James Brown walked on stage, and Mayor White was by his side. White addressed the crowd of around 2,000 and the row of television cameras.
"Now, I'm here tonight, like all of you, to listen to James. But I'm also here to ask for your help. I'm here to ask you to stay with me as your mayor, and to make Dr. King's dreams a reality in Boston. This is our city, and its future is in our hands. Tonight, and tomorrow, and the days that follow. So all I ask you tonight is this. Pledge that no matter what any other community might do, we in Boston will honor Dr. King in peace." Thank you.
And with that, James Brown, dressed in all black, grabs the microphone and takes over.
"I want you to know, ain't no sin, because I'm acting with my friend. Come on, help me now."
Then, just as James Brown dons his golden cape, a young man jumps on stage, and in an instant, a white police officer rushes in and throws the man back into the audience.
"Wait a minute.
It looks like the beginning of a riot that the entire city of Boston will witness on TV. Brown tells the police officers to let him handle it, and he shakes hands with another teenager who's jumped on stage.
"We're black. Don't make us all look bad. Let me finish doing this show. Don't make sense. Now, I asked the police to step back because I figured I could get some respect for my own people. And all we together win."
That night, there was rioting in over 100 U.S. cities. Dozens of people were killed. Huge areas of Newark, Detroit, and Washington, D.C. went up in flames. But Boston remained quiet. People stayed inside their homes, captivated by the James Brown Show.
Our story on the day the late Kevin White and James Brown saved Boston was produced by Michael May. This past Sunday in the church I attended, there was a note in the bulletin about the Super Bowl. This was not a prayer for the hometown team, the Patriots. It was a call for parishioners to get behind a move to highlight the dark side of one of the biggest events in sports, the increase in child sex trafficking. Now, an estimated 75,000 ticket holders will attend this year's Super Bowl in Indianapolis. Up to 50,000 more fans will come for the parties. And a chorus of voices from churches and human rights groups has been asking the state to send a signal to sex traffickers. They did. Legislators rewrote existing law, and Governor Mitch Daniels signed it. Maggie Clark is covering the issue for the State Line News Service. Maggie, what does this new law do? Because there was a previous anti-sex trafficking law on the books, correct?
Right. The original law had a provision in it that only allowed prosecution when the trafficker was the parent, guardian, or custodian of a child forced into prostitution or labor. So what the Indiana legislature did was they broadened the law to include prosecution of anyone over 18 who knowingly or intentionally sells or transfers custody of a child under 16 for prostitution or forced labor.
And it's a tougher punishment.
Yes, they moved it up from a Class B to a Class A felony, which in the state is punishable by 20 to 50 years in prison.
And just give us a sense of what other states do, because there are laws in other states as well.
Lawmakers in 20 states are actually currently debating bills related to stopping human trafficking, and they're from anything to establishing trafficking as a crime to providing additional appropriations for victim services, increasing criminal penalties for traffickers, and giving police extended authority to use wiretaps or subpoenas to investigate potential child sexual exploitation.
Well, we've reported on this before that, these trafficking rings are attracted to areas where there are so many people at times of these huge events like the Super Bowl. But one of the things that these human rights groups and religious groups are trying to do in Indianapolis this time is to band together to make sure the law gets enforced. Tell us a little bit about what they're doing.
This week, both local and national nonprofits and religious groups are traveling to Indianapolis to help the community prepare to assist victims of trafficking. Groups have been training Indianapolis cab drivers to recognize signs of trafficking, hotel employees, and also volunteers have been passing out thousands of bars of soap to area hotels and nightclubs, both with the trafficking hotline number and instructions on how to report trafficking or call to get help.
Those hotline numbers are on the wrappers of the soap. But as you well know, there's a debate over how big a problem this is. Now, you write, and we remember that in 2010 at the Super Bowl in Miami, six children were recovered from potential sexual exploitation. There were charges there. In 2011 at the Texas Super Bowl, 133 arrests were made in the 12 days before the game. And as you write, one case involved an international Chinese trafficking ring, and there were cases of sex trafficking of minors. So there are cases when they are appalling just, in and of themselves. But you say the debate is over how big a scale this is?
Correct. So, for example, in Dallas, their police sergeant estimated that between 50,000 and 100,000 prostitutes would come to Dallas. And according to the state attorney general's office and a federal trafficking task force, there were 133 arrests at the Dallas Super Bowl related to trafficking. So while this is certainly a problem, it isn't quite to the scale that some had predicted.
But as you said, rights groups are thrilled that the issue is, at least edging towards the spotlight at this big event.
Right. The event certainly does bring a spotlight to the issue. And what I did hear from people who research it really is that trafficking is a year-round issue, not just a Super Bowl issue.
But maybe this will put it in people's, front burners and they'll be thinking about it.
Right.
Maggie Clark, staff writer with the State Line Online News Service. Maggie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're learning more today about just who donated to those super PACs, those groups that can raise unlimited cash to support candidates. They have to disclose their donors every 3 months, and we'll share some of that with you. But the news is that Republicans are definitely outraising Democrats. And there's another headline about a nonprofit arm of one of these super PACs. Now, the nonprofits don't have to disclose donors. Crossroads GPS is the nonprofit arm of Karl Rove's super PAC, American Crossroads. And Crossroads GPS is really raking in the money, as we're about to hear. They're out today with their second ad. It slams President Obama's green jobs program and attacks his administration's financial backing of the now bankrupt solar panel maker Solyndra.
Tell President Obama we need jobs, not more insider deals. Crossroads GPS is responsible for the content of this advertising.
A little sound from Crossroads GPS. So joining us now, Dave Leventhal. He's the influence reporter for Politico. So that has to do with money, I'm assuming. And so, Dave, remind us, these nonprofits like Crossroads GPS, they're 501c4s. They are allowed to attack issues but not candidates. Although, as we heard in that ad, that's a fine line.
By definition, they are regarded as social welfare organizations, nonprofit groups that do something that's supposed to be in the public interest, ostensibly. But they're allowed to, so long as it's not a primary purpose for them, engage in political activity. But what we've seen dating back to really the last election cycle is that several of them have become incredibly active in politics and, in some people's opinion, are running roughshod of that idea that they exist to do something other than engage in politics.
The IRS at one point was considering looking into them, this idea that they're considered not profits, they don't have to disclose. But how big a part of the money story are they? We said that we mentioned Crossroads GPS, the nonprofit arm of the super PAC of Karl Rove, American Crossroads. We are learning with the money that's coming in, with the reports that are coming in, we're learning that together, Crossroads GPS and American Crossroads have raised $51 million. That seems like a huge number. So first, put that in context. How do you compare that to the campaign, or rather to the super PACs and the campaigns of Romney and Gingrich?
What we're finding, and we were up late last night looking at all of these numbers, and that in some cases, super PACs, which are one flavor of independent outside group that can support or oppose political candidates, in some cases they're raising more than the candidates themselves. For example, Mitt Romney's super PAC, the one that is at least supporting him independently, actually had more cash on hand, more than $23 million, than Romney's campaign did. So you can just see from that one example how much money some of these outside groups are actually bringing in, more than the candidates. And to talk about the nonprofit groups now, what we don't know is who is actually fueling their efforts. What we do know is that they are incredibly strong vehicles for, number one, raising money, and number two, making very overtly political advertisements sometimes that can oftentimes be very negative in their nature. And this is not unique to Republicans or Democrats. Both sides are doing this, and largely this has all been brought about to the extent that it is today by a couple of Supreme Court and federal court decisions dating back to 2010 that really shook up the campaign finance landscape as we know it now.
So just to review here, we're seeing American Crossroads, which is a super PAC, and it's a nonprofit arm, Crossroads GPS, raising $51 million. You have other super PACs that are supporting Mitt Romney, raising, you know, sounds like half that. You have Newt Gingrich's super PAC. We know that the casino magnate Sheldon Adelson, he and his wife together gave, I think, something like $10 million to Winning Our Future, the Gingrich super PAC. So we're hearing the money. Are we hearing any more about who's behind at least the money of the super PACs? Because again, you know, the nonprofits don't have to disclose.
Correct. And the super PACs, we do know because of the way the federal law reads who funds them. We don't necessarily get that information in a timely fashion, sometimes having to wait months for it, at least up until this point. But we've seen it come from, in some cases, very, very wealthy business people. In some cases, such as with Mitt Romney's super PAC, from corporations directly who are allowed to make direct donations right from their treasury. You got about $5.5 million in the super PAC that's supporting him directly from corporations. corporate entities. So this is really something that is unique to this presidential election because, of course, we did not have super PACs back in 2008 as it applies to the presidential election. So really for all of us and for the candidates and the campaigns themselves, this is the first go-around. We're really entering new territory and, to an extent, making the rules up as we all go along.
Here are some of the other donors that we're learning about. There is a pro-Obama super PAC, Priorities USA Action. DreamWorks CEO Jeffrey Katzenberg donated $2 million to that. Last year, hedge fund managers Robert Mercer, Julian Robertson, and Paul Singer each gave $1 million contributions to the pro-Mitt Romney super PAC, Restore Our Future. But I guess I'm still stuck on this question of you've got the super PACs, which have to disclose and can advocate for candidates. You've got the nonprofit PACs that are supposed to be oriented around issues. They don't have to disclose. But the lines are so blurred. I mean, what do you think is going to happen here?
They are extremely blurred, and some people might ask, well, why wouldn't you all just, start a nonprofit organization? Why bother
right.
with super PACs? Well, one portion of that, number one, is vanity. Some people like to have their information disclosed. If you are wealthy and you want to be politically active and well-known for that, it behooves you to donate to an organization or a vehicle that does disclose its dollars. So that's a practical consideration. A more legal one is that nonprofit organizations, again, should not have a primary purpose of engaging in politics. And there is some concern among nonprofit groups that if they do get too overtly political, that the Internal Revenue Service or the Federal Election Commission or Congress or even the courts will begin to go after them. But at least to this point, they really have not done anything. They've punted. The IRS has looked into this matter and then stopped an investigation. The Federal Election Commission has not really taken it up. Congress tried to pass an act called the Disclose Act back in 2010, which stalled in the Senate and went nowhere, being revisited now, but still nothing. So I talked to the commissioner of the Federal Election Commission today, who said largely the disclosure rules, at least as they apply to super PACs, are probably going to stay in place certainly through the rest of this current election cycle, and there's no indication on the IRS end that anything is going to change or that they're going to start cracking down on any of these nonprofit organizations that, again, in some people's opinion, are engaging in political activity too overtly or too much.
And by the way, we know that President Obama has raised $224.6 million in 2011, at least, for his campaign and the Democratic Party, but these are donations that come through traditional, with traditional restrictions. They can only be, a certain amount. We're talking about the super PACs, which are the unlimited amounts. And boy, American Crossroads and Crossroads GPS raking in $51 million. Dave Leventhal, influence reporter for Politico. Dave, thanks so much. We'll continue to check in with you as the race continues. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's take a second to air some of your thoughts on a recent story. We spoke with historian Mark Perry, who wrote this fascinating story in Foreign Policy magazine. It details how, during the Bush administration, Israeli Mossad agents passed themselves off as American CIA agents to recruit terrorists from the Sunni insurgent group Jundallah to wage attacks in Iran. Now, this was something that strained U.S.-Israeli relations because, as a retired U.S. intelligence officer told Mark, the U.S. doesn't do bang and boom or assassinations. Well, many of you were fascinated, but listener Mark Miller writes, this claim that the U.S. doesn't do assassinations is ludicrous on its face in light of the fact that most of our current war on terrorism is based on drone attacks. But Mark also went on to say that we should have pointed out that the Israelis have denied this so-called Mossad false flag operation, and that our guest, Mark Perry, had a bias against Israel because he had past ties with Palestinians. Well, it is true that one Israeli official has denied the plot, but Mark Perry says Mossad hasn't. He also acknowledges he was an unpaid advisor to Yasser Arafat, but was also friends with Yitzhak Rabin, who shared a Nobel Peace Prize with Arafat and Shimon Peres. We have more of Mark's response and the original story at hereandnow.org. And meanwhile, we had another response to Mark Perry's mention of the exiled Iranian group Mujahideen al-Halk. Mark said they were also a violent terrorist organization fighting for regime change in Tehran with support from U.S. policymakers. Well, that comment prompted this call from Ali in Charlottesville, Virginia.
I was listening, and I really was upset just because the guy was making huge allegations about how this is a very violent terrorist organization. It's absolutely not. I've known these people for quite some time. Mujahideen Khalif is a historical organization, resistance. It was founded by middle-class, well-educated, progressive-thinking people. And to say that they're extremely violent is completely inaccurate. This group has officially renounced violence over a decade ago.
So there you have it. A lot of response to that story. We'd always love to hear from you on any story. Just go to hereandnow.org.
The marathon is unpredictable. It's variable. It has a certain mystique and a romance about it that you can't put in a box and you can't write criteria for, you can't define. And that's the beauty of it.
That's former marathon world record holder Rob DiCostella of Australia, reflecting on the 2011 Boston Marathon, when Kenya's Jeffrey Mutai ran the fastest marathon in history, 2 hours, 3 minutes, 2 seconds. That incredible time, nearly a minute better than the previous best, is an indication of just how fast someone can run 26.2 miles. And it has marathon fans anticipating the biggest race of this year, the Olympics in London in August. Of course, the fastest marathoners in the world now come from Africa, and countries like Kenya and Ethiopia have dozens of runners to choose from as they assemble their Olympic teams. But the American team is set. Six men and women punched their tickets to London during the Olympic marathon trials in Houston on January 14th. Here Now's Alex Ashlock was in Texas for those trials, and he has this report.
Runners set. And off we go. The road to London begins in Houston.
This was the first time the men's and women's marathon trials have been held in the same place on the same day, and the competition attracted thousands of fans who lined the looping course, which started and finished on the Avenue of Americas in downtown Houston. Woo! 36-year-old Meb Keflezighi became the oldest man to win the U.S. trials. He completed the mostly flat 26.2-mile course in 2 hours, 9 minutes, and 30 seconds. Keflezighi is the son of Eritrean refugees who fled famine and civil war on the Horn of Africa, coming to the U.S. 25 years ago. Running down the home stretch, he waved a small American flag he had snatched from a fan, a move he said was inspired by Joan Benoit Samuelson when she won the first women's Olympic marathon in Los Angeles in 1984. And at the finish line, his 74-year-old father, Rusum, hoisted Meb on his shoulders.
I feel great. I'm very glad, really. I'm proud of my son, too. Thanks to God. Thanks to God, the great. We gave him a chance to win.
This will be Keflezighi's third Olympics. 8 years ago in Athens, he won marathon silver. He made the team this time around after recovering from an infected foot he suffered in the New York Marathon back in November. In that race, Keflezighi left a breathing strip meant for his nose inside his shoe, causing the injury and limiting his training for the trials. But it didn't seem to matter.
It's not about even first, second, or third. It's all about being the team. So it's just an honor to be on the stage, on the podium, to be able to go to London.
The other members of the U.S. marathon team are Ryan Hall and Abdi Abdurrahman. Hall won the marathon trials 4 years ago. He finished 10th in the marathon in Beijing. Abdurrahman is on his fourth Olympic team, having qualified 3 times at 10,000 meters. Ryan Hall has been America's best hope in the marathon in recent years. In Boston last April, he ran the fastest ever marathon for an American, 2 hours, 4 minutes, and 58 seconds. But that was good for only fourth place, and he has never won a major marathon. He led this race from the starting gun, running the first mile in 4 minutes and 52 seconds, calling it practice for medaling in London this summer.
What it's going to take is running a race like we did today. I mean, you're going to have to go early, you're going to have to commit to the pace, and it's going to be a war of attrition out there. The marathon's changed. Sammy changed it. Guys aren't afraid anymore to go out hard, and so we got to be prepared to go out and, you know, run a very fast opening half.
Sammy was Sammy Wanjiru, the Kenyan runner who won the marathon in Beijing in 2008. It was a performance hailed as one of the top marathons of all time because of the extreme heat and humidity and Wanjiru's Olympic record time, 2 hours, 6 minutes, and 32 seconds. Wanjiro died in a fall from a balcony after a domestic dispute with his wife last May. Competing in just her second marathon, Shalane Flanagan won the women's race at the Olympic Trials in Houston. Her time, 2 hours, 25 minutes, and 38 seconds, was more than 3 minutes faster than her first marathon. She believes she's capable of running even faster.
It just shows that there's more work to be done, and to put myself in contention in London. But it's encouraging to know that, you know, I'm making progress with each marathon.
Flanagan will be competing in her third straight Olympics. She finished third and won a bronze medal in the 10,000-meter race in Beijing. She leads an American team that will also include Kara Goucher, who ran the 5 and 10K in Beijing, and Desiree Davila, who will be making her Olympic debut. Davila was second in Houston. Goucher was third. When those women crossed the finish line in Houston, they were greeted by Olympic champion Joan Benoit Samuelson, who served as the official starter for the women's race.
I'm thrilled. Thrilled that they're representing the United States, and I'm thrilled I'm still involved in the sport, and it's going to be a great team in London.
To put things in perspective, American women have won only 2 medals in the Olympic marathon. American men have only 3 Olympic marathon medals in the modern era. Last Friday, 3 Ethiopian runners in the Dubai Marathon posted times faster than Ryan Hall's best. And Kenyan runners swept all 6 major marathons in 2011. So for the American marathon runners, the road to London may have started in Houston. Whether it also ended there remains to be seen.
Here and Now's Alex Ashlock. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.